The assignment of Sunday services is done mostly on the basis of the complexity of the calendar, who's in town, when, and all of that. When you've been repeating the service readings for as many years as I have, you naturally have your favorites, and you naturally have the ones that you hope above all that you'll never be assigned. I think Adam and Eve is way at the bottom of the list of every single sermon giver's, whoever wants to go there. So this was a weekend of interesting contrast because we just had our wonderful play of the Land of Golden Sunshine, which was completely delightful and uplifting and gives a person plenty to talk about on Sunday morning. And then there's good old Adam and Eve poking their heads on the other side. But very interesting correlations have come to my mind, which are either going to prove disastrous or interesting, so we'll just set out and see which way we go. There is that line in the Bible. Of course, Master says that the Adam and Eve story is a very interesting and subtle allegory, completely tied to what Biraj and Erica were chanting about with the Irda and the Pingala and all of the internal energies. But there's also that simple line in there that Adam and Eve ate of the fruit of the tree of life planted in the center of the garden, and they gained knowledge of good and evil. And of course, that's been way spun out into sexuality, which is evil, and all of this. That's why the Adam and Eve story is not a popular. If you have a choice, if you're going to get to choose, you don't choose it, because it's just a little complicated to embrace in a public forum. So, but the way Swamiji talks about what Adam and Eve perceived as good and evil is what they perceived was duality. That what happens is we are in the singularity of spirit, but then what happens to us is that oneness of spirit gets divided. And good and evil is the obvious way to say it, but everything about this world is in pairs. And because of that feeling of always being only half of what we know we're meant to be, that is the whole long story of the soul's journey. Once that essential unity is broken, and in this allegory, it's because they ate of the tree, which is really to say that they looked outward. They looked outward for their life experience and began to find, as we all find, as all babies find, you look outward from your experience and there is this immediate experience that you can have. Little children are reaching and grabbing. I watched little Leia Mahoney, when she was about 2 minutes old, reach up and grab the enormous hand of her father, Chaitanya. I mean, the baby's hand was so small, and the little baby grabbed a hold of her daddy's thumb, and at that point also just grabbed his heart and held it like that, you know, forever. But it was also just astonishing to me just how fast she went out like that, and the strength with which she gripped, and the whole cycle that you could see starting once you begin to feel yourself to be separated. And if we think about everything that we do in our lives, we're always looking for that point of satisfaction. And of course, the most dramatic place that we see it is the duality of male and female, and what turns into the physical impelling desire. You know, whatever form that takes, it's that fundamental feeling that there has to be another half that I'm looking for. Now, Swamiji also writes about this whole concept of the inner kingdom. And he talks about how every one of us is this whole kingdom within ourselves, with all of these different citizens that all have different attitudes. Each one, as he describes, a complete personality and world in itself. All of them are tied together by the ego, but we have, as he puts it, he says, we have certain citizens that are working for the good of all. These are all internally. These are our loving impulses, our compassionate impulses, the desire to meditate. We have the welfare of the whole civilization in mind, and we move toward it. And then we have other citizens within us, anger, greed, jealousy, loneliness, all of those envy, all of the meannesses of the heart. And they're so busy working for themselves, they don't have any idea, really, what is for the good of all. And then the ego, who is really everybody, just like an actor on the stage, he plays all the parts, he's trying, either wisely or stupidly, to sort of manage this team that's going in all different directions. It was a very interesting, I was contemplating it this morning, because you know, we tend to identify sometimes with the parts of us that aren't working so well. So it was very interesting to just think of it impartially as just a collection of citizens, some of whom have a more altruistic attitude than others have. And they're all just kind of the folks in your town that you're going to have to deal with all the time. And he talks about how the ones who have the welfare of all engaged are able to deal with other kingdoms, as he puts it, meaning other individuals, because they know that diplomatic relations are required. And the selfish ones are just busy sabotaging all of this. Now, we all experience this as all these different, and the word, one of the words for it is just all these different feelings within it, isn't it? We feel profoundly uplifted, and in that upliftment, we come closer into the inner kingdom, and that fundamental sense of duality is eased, because we recognize that the essential split is not really anywhere out there, but it's deep within ourselves. But that fracturing is constantly, it comes together and then it fractures, it comes together and then it fractures. Those of us who were privileged to participate in this play that we did the last two nights, it was at the end of the first performance, of course, having spent a great deal of time working on this and having a pretty good idea that it was going to work. But at the end of the first performance, when we just really knew that it had really done what we had hoped it would do, there was just such an integrated feeling. And not merely because our little kingdom had come together, our little troupe had come together, but also because of the actual experience. The whole theme of the play, for those of you who didn't hear it, is the soul's long journey, which is the deep longing within all of us to be united with the light, and the opportunity that our heroine has in this story to courageously step into the light, to unite all her citizens in the right direction, and the fact that most people don't make that choice. Out of 1,000, one seeks. That's what it says in the Bhagavad Gita. So the second night we were doing this, Marcel was sort of urging us, you know, to go right back into that sense of complete and calm unity, and then bring that out again when we performed it again. Now, I'm now going to sort of try to tie what I learned from Adam and Eve a little bit into the experience of working on that play and other things that I've been learning in the last 6 months about art and creativity. It's the things that the characteristics of this path of self-realization, as Yogananda and as Kriyananda have given it to us, are not arbitrary or accidental. There are many unique features, starting with Master himself, that were not common in many avatars and saints that came ahead of time. It's part of Dwapara Yuga. It's also part of the unique characteristics of this family. And one of the features about Master, which is very interesting, is that he was a creative artist. I mean, many highly evolved saints are also creative artists, but not all. Master wrote poetry, Master wrote music, and he talked about creativity being under the control of your will. He expressed himself poetically. He wasn't austere. He embraced life. He wanted to make things beautiful. Look at the design of the lake shrine. I mean, just think how original that is. And Master himself just decided on that, the gates of Encinitas. He had this picture in his mind of something that hadn't been done before. Even this particular arch that we use on our temple, this was something that Master himself drew. And he wanted it just sort of just like this. Swamiji drew it out as closely as he could to mimic what Master had done. He not only lived in this world in the remembrance of God, but he used creative art as a way to express it. And Swami Kriyananda is just breathtaking in his creativity. You can't compare yourself or even begin to, because there's nothing to compare to what Swamiji has done. 150 books, 400 pieces of music, thousands of photographs, architecture, and his greatest art form is all of us. Just taking our energy and finding a way for us to express ourselves. And he wrote a book called Art as a Hidden Message. And the first time I read that book, I have to read Swami's books just over and over to understand them. But the first time I read it, I got the impression that in order to become a saint, you have to first become an artist. And that was a little, wow, I didn't quite know what to do with that. And recently I had the opportunity to be with Dana Anderson, who's a painter, beautiful painter. The covers of many of Swami's books have been done by her. She's made a serious study of creativity. And I participated in a workshop that she did about creativity. And she said something at the beginning that was so brilliant and seemed so apt, because she's really, Swamiji has given us so many different threads that different people can make a lifetime out of different threads. And she's made a lifetime out of creativity. And the way she explained it is, she said, and this is how Swami said it, we all live all the time with all of these different citizens. We have envy, fighting against self-acceptance. We have jealousy, fighting against self-worth. We have altruism, fighting against what's in it for me. And all of these forces are always moving like this. And the way Dana described it, she said, in a healthy society, people use art as a way to express themselves. You know, if you think of a traditional culture, the men gather around the fire at night and they dance together, and then the women have their dance, and the women quilt and sing, and the men hunt and sing together. And I mean, everybody's always doing something. And we're carving icons and we're painting our houses. And what is happening is that people are taking what they feel and they're translating it into their version of beauty or whatever it is. Or you have war dances where you take even that aggressive energy and you make it so powerful that you have those feelings and you make it into an art form so that it passes through you. And what Dana says, in our culture, we have two ways of dealing with feelings. We suppress them or we project them onto someone near us. Because spontaneous creativity has basically been taken away from us. As she said, you give a child a piece of paper and a crayon and he doesn't need instruction. Although somebody said, yes, he'll eat the crayon and flush the paper down the toilet. No, most children will just take the crayon and they'll do this. You put on the music and the kid just starts going like this. You don't have to tell the child to dance. The child just knows what to do because it hears the music, it feels it, and it comes through. So she was talking about how, you know, what we need to get back to. And our particular seminar, creativity seminar, was not for excellent artists to become superb. It was for inhibited people to become 4 years old. You know, so it was just to find that again. And we used a lot of crayons and paints. And it was actually very interesting for me, because I have many forms of creativity, but paint or crayons is not one of mine. I have never in my life until there, not since I was a little child and somebody told me I couldn't draw, which happened really early, I've never picked up a crayon and tried to think about some feeling reality that is important to me and use the crayon to say it. So, since I can't draw, that's exactly what I did. I held the crayons and the paints and the chalks in my hands, and I thought of many different things in my life that have happened to me, uplifting and challenging and so on. And then I tried to just use a crayon and just allow it to flow through. Just let it happen. And she had this exercise, which, I mean, this is a a huge long commercial for Dana's seminars, which I really endorse. But after we had done this stuff, she paired us up and sent us outside and made us dance our painting. You know, your first thought is, I would rather die. Just, I'll take a bullet instead. But you just kind of got yourself together. But it was astonishing to just look. And then you had to dance your partner's painting. So it wasn't then you weren't going through what you knew, but you were just going through what you looked at. You know, how do you take a squiggle line that ends in a circle? How does that run through your body? And it was, I can only say it was amazing. Last night, yes, it was last night when we were in the middle of our play and we had the four beautiful ladies with all this fantastic gold stuff, you know, just dancing here. And I, being the narrator, was over on the side, and the placement wasn't quite exactly right, and Sneha ended up very close to me, so that she was coming right at me, and she's not here, and I couldn't ask her. But she just came right to me and twirled around like that, and it was magnificent. And she's a good dancer, you know, I don't think she could get into a professional troupe. But more than that, you could just feel that just that whole force was just moving through her. And of course, for everyone watching it, I just felt it too. You know, this is who we are. We are all of these feelings. And pure intuition, Swamiji says, is calm feeling. In other words, all these feelings are always at war with each other, and what we need to do is to bring them into perfect resolution. And this is where Swami's talking about how do we actually do that. And when we try to put it forward, I'll speak again last night, the beginning of the program, these same four dancers who end up all in gold start out in these many different storms. They dance a storm, and the only music is the sound of the wind. And prior to this, most of the dance we had in the temple, you know, was door of my heart open wide. I'm joking, because they're much more beautiful than that. But all of a sudden, thunder, lightning, and Swami's words are pillaging, shouting, ripping, tearing, terrifying. But you know, all of us, we have those citizens in there. We may have civilized them, do you know? But they're still there. And more than that, they're part of God's creation. And anything that we're afraid of really runs us, whether we admit it or not. And watching just the transformation of our wonderful friends as step by step by step they surrendered to the possibility, even to the point where they were shouting and you know, shouting out loud when they first started vocalizing. I said to them afterwards, look, you're supposed to sound like you can inflict pain, not like you're in pain. But it was just so hard to allow that much energy, because we only have two ways of dealing with energy in our society. We suppress it or we project it. We don't just step into it and just step into it and let it be whatever it is. You know, all of life is the same. Think of the image in Hinduism of the mother Kali. It's a really hard one for a lot of Westerners to get. She has a necklace that's made out of human skulls. And this is why the Christian missionaries had a really hard time understanding what was going on in India when they got there. Oh yes, here's, you know, a goddess, and she's hideous. She has a red tongue sticking out, she has this big black hair, she's holding a sword like this, and she's wearing a garland of skulls, or maybe it's hanging from her waist, I don't recall, but you know, she's not pretty. Really not at all pretty. And we have two ways of dealing with our feelings, don't we? We either suppress them or we project them. We don't deify them. Now, I'm not a worshiper of the dark side, and yoga doesn't speak of how we really get over things by projecting them. You know, you don't just scream at the people you hate. That's different. But what Kali personifies, and with that skull, with one hand she has a sword, and with the other hand, she's blessing. And I understood Kali once when we were in Calcutta during the Kali Puja, the Kali festival, when every neighborhood had a huge Kali statue somewhere, and we were out on the street, and we were in a crowd, and the crowd kept kind of backing us up until, unbeknownst to me, I was about this far away from this humongous Kali statue, and I didn't know. And I turned around, and you know, she was basically leering over me like this. And I just sort of looked at her, and I said to her, "Who are you? What are you doing here?" And what came to me so perfectly, and just in that moment, was there had to have been a human instrument for Kali. Somebody saw Kali. And that's what I felt. I felt like some great saint, like Paramhansa Yogananda, who came with a true message, had this vision of reality and all these different citizens within us, in our inner world, where you see God as chopping your head off and blessing you at the same time. So he put it, she put it, into this creative form. And you look at it, and it begins to communicate on a very, very, very different level. It just begins to communicate who I am, what I'm supposed to do with all of this, how all of these dualities eventually reconcile. We don't get to that freedom, but there's no shortcut to it. We're a plant, and we're growing. I've talked about that before. You know, we have these fruit trees in our community now, and I'm nurturing this little fig tree and this little orange tree and this medium-sized apricot tree, and just really trying to persuade this little fig tree that is about this big. He lives about 10 feet from a fig tree that is about half the size of our house. And I'm not sure whether it's discouraging to him or encouraging. I really don't know. So I talked to him about it. You know, you can do it. You can do it. But there's no way that tree can skip any of those stages. And we, with all these mental citizens, we're just hoping that some of them will lose their way. But they won't lose their way because they're all tied in with us. And we just have to figure out how to bring them all into an understanding. And Master giving us, and Swamiji even more strongly giving us, sing, dance, do theater, write poetry, publish books. You know, just take all of this that you know and put it out in front of you. Because in doing that, you begin to understand who you are, what you feel. There was a time in Swami's life when he first met Rosanna Golia, the woman he married for in the 80s. He was married to her for about 6 or 7 years. She was younger than he was. And when they first met, Swami had a very strong understanding of where this was going to go. And he remarked very interestingly. He said, "It's a little harder for her to get used to." And then Swami said it so simply, "I am accustomed to following my heart." And he said, no matter how it may look, you know, she was caught in their age differences, their cultural differences. She overcame all of that in time. But for him, it was no obstacle. But what a phrase. "I am accustomed to following my heart." You wouldn't just sort of see Swamiji with that phrase most commonly, because he had such a brilliant mind and such a strong will. You don't think of, usually when you hear that phrase, you think of someone who's a lot more airy-fairy about it, you know, just following their heart here and there. But Swami just said it with that much strength, because he had been working for many incarnations to just bring this duality into one. So the heart itself was a place of unity. You know, the heart is where those feelings reside. The heart is where they do battle. Swamiji said on another occasion, we think that the art of meditation is calming the mind. He said it's actually calming the heart, because the heart is where all those citizens fight. Because it's the feelings, the agitated feelings, that cause the mind to be restless. And this is where the idea of finding wholesome creative outlets for all those feelings then brings the heart into line. And then when the heart is into line, then the citizens are in order. Many years ago, this woman, Sherry Edwards, she had this healing method that was based on sound. And it was a tremendous power that she herself had been given, which she tried to objectify without any success. But Swamiji was fascinated by what she did, and he brought her to Ananda, and for months we had her little sound machines, and people were buying them and adjusting them, and let's just say the results were mixed, and eventually the experiment was abandoned. At the end of it, after months of this, she said very casually, "Oh, you don't need any of these machines because you chant and sing." Just like that. Why did Master give us those chants? And Master, it's interesting to note, changed the style of chanting. He didn't pick up the traditional Indian style of just repeating the names of gods in all these different ways. He gave us poetry. He gave us meaning. He gave us ideas so that not only are we having the power of melody, but we're also having the power of the affirmation. And all those songs of Swamiji's, I'm not a good singer, so I can't just belt them out for you, so I have to say them more as the poetry, but in the line, "Emerald Isle, as we with our maker united with would be," he says. He's talking about the ocean, the water going to the ocean. "As we with our maker united with be," and then he changes it, "as we with our maker reunited would be." I was just feeling that. There's just two lines from one of the hundreds of songs he's written. But we would be united? Oh, because united makes us feel that darned Adam and Eve duality, doesn't it? I'm separated. I want to be united. And that's why we're pushing in all directions. But then Swami takes it just one step farther. Oh, the separation itself was an illusion, wasn't it? And just singing those two lines over and over, there's a whole lifetime of teaching right there, isn't there? And last night our play ends with the song, "Why?" And then into her heart stole the secret of oneness, the bond not even time can untie. What does that mean? That means that all of this endless, where we're together, we're apart, we're together, we're apart, we're together, we're apart, humanly, divinely, finally, there it is. And then, in love, she at last learned why. It all resolves so beautifully, doesn't it? That's our journey. Reunited with our Maker. God bless you all.